I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. A 2016 case of child abuse and neglect in San Antonio shed an ugly light on what's not a very dark and dirty secret. A 3-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy were discovered in a backyard by police officers. Their hands and feet were bound so tightly they could hardly move. 6 other children were discovered inside the home without supervision. One man was found guilty in the case. One other woman is serving 50 years, and the children's mother is awaiting trial. Over 174,000 cases of child abuse and neglect in Texas were investigated by the State Department of Family and Protective Services in 2017. Bexar County is 4th in the state of Texas for the highest number of confirmed victims of child abuse and neglect. Over 15,000 cases were investigated in Bexar County in 2017. 5,500 cases were confirmed. That's an increase of nearly 1,000 from 2016. The trauma that's inflicted on children in these instances is unimaginable, but there are resources and treatments available to children and their families. Diana Ochoa Johnson is Chief Clinical Officer with the Children's Shelter in San Antonio, a nonprofit trauma-informed care certified organization that services child survivors of abuse, neglect, and abandonment. Dr. Susana Rivera is a licensed professional counselor in Laredo, Texas, and is a trainer and consultant on trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. Ochoa Johnson addressed the reasons behind the increase in child abuse and neglect in Bexar County.
I think it's a combination of factors, which is often the case with, you know, abuse and neglect. But, you know, we have a very high domestic violence rate in San Antonio as well. And so those two kind of go hand in hand. Some of our community factors, such as poverty, low educational attainment for many of our adults here in Bexar County. Substance abuse, San Antonio continues to be a major drug corridor, so we have issues related to those kinds of things. So it's a number of factors, really.
And Dr. Rivera, you are there in Laredo, and do you see similar factors coming into play in your stretch of South Texas?
Absolutely. We are not that far south from San Antonio. We're about 150 miles south, and being on the border, yes, we are seeing the high poverty levels. I believe out of 254 counties in Texas, Webb County is the 12th poorest. So the high poverty rates certainly contribute to higher rates of child abuse, but also the fact that we have so many undocumented families living in South Texas, particularly along the border. A lot of these families are not aware of services that are available to them. They are afraid to seek services because of their immigration status. They're afraid of detection. They're afraid of being reported. They're just afraid of the system in general, and oftentimes I think that they associate us as being part of the system. So I believe that the high rates of undocumented immigrants are certainly contributing to this. There are so many fears right now. All of the fears that are related to undocumented immigrants, you know, immigration status, everything that's happening with DACA right now, I think that is also contributing to the stress level for a lot of families. And we know that the higher the stress level, the higher the likelihood that children are going to be abused and neglected.
And so there are many different types of abuse that children and their families face. It could be physical abuse, it could be psychological abuse, it could be sexual abuse. Dr. Rivera, tell us the ways that these types of traumatic stress, and if you know of any other kinds of traumatic stress that might be affecting children that we might not be familiar with, how is that affecting children and their development?
When you have a child who has been trauma exposed, rather than developing optimally, all of that energy that would be typically put into typical childhood development is instead going into surviving the moment, surviving the traumatic experiences that they are facing. So their development can be stunted or it can be delayed because they're just so focused on being in crisis mode and just surviving that it's very difficult for them to put that attention and that energy into progressing on to the next developmental stage. And that can be cognitive development, it can be social development, it can be behavioral development. And aside from your well-known physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, there are a lot of other things that children are experiencing. My colleague, Diana, mentioned domestic violence in families. But growing up with family violence, that does impact a child's development. I go back to immigration. There are many instances where one parent is documented and the other is not. So that can be a source of domestic violence, threatening the undocumented parent with immigration. But we also see children that are being exposed to school violence. And we're seeing a lot of children who are being afraid to go to school now because they no longer feel safe. But bullying is a form of school violence. And so we have children who are afraid to go to school because they are being picked on. There's a lot of cyberbullying. So we see that children are being driven to suicide because bullying has become so extensive and so severe. And we also have children who are experiencing military-related traumas. So having loved ones who are deployed, they fear for their safety. Service members may come back with their own post-traumatic stress or with physical injuries and limitations, and that certainly changes the dynamics in the home. We have children who are experiencing traumatic grief, not necessarily because of death, but because of separation, maybe, again, deportation or a parent who is incarcerated. Divorce can also be very traumatic for children. So there are a lot of different ways in which children are experiencing traumatic stress that go beyond some type of physical or sexual abuse.
Well, Diana, I'm sure you've seen, if not some, then all of the types of abuse and neglect that Dr. Rivera just mentioned. What is one way the children's shelter is trying to approach a lot of these problems? Is there some kind of a therapy or behavioral program that you use to address many of these issues?
Yes, in our Hope Center, which is our outpatient mental health clinic, all of our therapists are trained in evidence-based models for treating trauma. Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is one of them. We also use trust-based relational intervention model, which comes out of Texas Christian University, the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. And we have trained not only our clinicians and our social workers, but really all of our direct care staff. Everyone that comes in to work at the children's shelter is trained in this model. And it's designed to create safety for children first and foremost. And what I mean by that is physical, but also emotional safety. And we know that healing only begins when children feel safe. And families and adults too. So it's really a combination of things. It's our physical environment, but also the training that we provided. And then finally, the treatment models that we're using with children and families.
Dr. Rivera, I understand that you have adopted this trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy for Latinos. Can you explain what adaptations needed to be made in order to focus it more appropriately to this group of people?
So the adaptation for Latino families was actually originally done by Dr. Michael De Arellano, who is with the Medical University of South Carolina. I was fortunate enough to meet him and convince him to pilot this here in South Texas. What we did was we had to incorporate cultural constructs that were relevant for Hispanic families. So what we did was we looked at what are the cultural constructs that are relevant to a Hispanic family. So extended family is very, very critical. So we looked at what is the role of the extended family? Who is the matriarch in the family? So is it necessary to involve maybe grandmother or other adults who play a significant role in the child's life? We looked at spirituality. We're always taught in graduate school that we don't incorporate religion into treatment. But when you have Latino families who perhaps are very devout in their spirituality, a large percentage of Latino families are predominantly Roman Catholic. Do they turn to religion in times of adversity? So we want to make it okay to, without imposing our own religious beliefs, to allow them to talk about religion. If that means beginning or ending session with a prayer, that is fine. Praying to a specific saint, One very common one that I see in my practice is praying to St. Jude, who is the patron saint of difficult cases. Along with that, we also realize that a lot of Latino families really have a lot of faith in curanderismo. So we want to allow them to speak about those beliefs. And we took all of those things that are unique to a Latino family, always making sure, though, that while we're trying to be culturally sensitive, we're not individually insensitive. When we piloted this, we did see a 93% success rate compared to just doing treatment as usual. But we're also seeing a lot less dropout because 50% of Latino families are not going to return to treatment after the first session. But by adapting treatment for their culture and their cultural beliefs, their cultural norms, we do see greater engagement, greater retention, and thus greater benefit from treatment.
Do you have to reach out to the curanderas and to the priests to say you are probably being approached by many people who are faced with incidents of abuse in their family? Please direct them to have professional care, because a lot of families want to eschew professional help because they think that their priests or their curanderas are going to be the answer to their problems.
Absolutely. In fact, as I started hearing more and more about curanderismo, there was one name that kept popping up. So I actually sought her out. I introduced myself. I told her who I am and the kind of work that I do. And I wanted to learn what she does. What would she say to a family who came to her because they were facing adversity? How would she offer help to them? And so if they believe that perhaps lighting a certain candle is going to be helpful to them, if they believe that maybe using a certain oil or anything like that is going to be helpful, I'm certainly going to encourage that because this is something that they firmly believe in and there's nothing wrong with it. So I'm going to approach them with what I'm doing is going to supplement this. And I've actually built a pretty good relationship with the curandera, and she has referred a lot of families to me. And likewise with the Catholic Church. I myself am Catholic, and I've also talked to them about the work that I do and how we can work together to help families.
We've been speaking with Dr. Susana Rivera, a licensed professional counselor in Laredo, Texas, a trainer and consultant on trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. We also heard from Diana Ochoa Johnson, chief clinical officer with the Children's Shelter in San Antonio. The Children's Shelter is hosting the inaugural South Texas Trauma-Informed Care Conference, May 10th and 11th in San Antonio. Dr. Rivera will be one of the presenters along with other trauma experts. The goal of the conference is to build a multidisciplinary network of trauma-informed care in South Texas. Coming up on Fronteras, Fiesta is an 11-day celebration in San Antonio filled with parades, food, and dance that honors the heroes of Texas independence. But there are some people who feel conflicted in celebrating an event that oppressed a large part of the population.
It wasn't anything where we saw ourselves. The Mexican-American community didn't see itself reflected in the fiesta as a ritual.
That's coming up next on Fronteras. Stay with us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Fiesta is an 11-day celebration in San Antonio that honors the heroes of the Alamo and the defeat of the Mexican Army at the Battle of San Jacinto. From what began as a simple parade around the Alamo in 1891, it's expanded to a couple of handfuls of parades, an oyster bake, and about 110 more events that give San Antonians a reason to party. Fiesta has also grown into a giant fundraiser for nearly 100 nonprofits in the region. But the transition from commemorating the road to Texas independence to an 11-day philanthropic party is a long and complicated one, especially when one considers the racial implications behind Fiesta. Mexican Americans were essentially excluded from participating in the early days of Fiesta. It incorporated royalty, namely the coronation every year of King Antonio, who was up until this past year an Anglo. Over the years, Fiesta has morphed into a Mexican-American-themed event with mariachis, a variety of foods, and decorations made with papel picado, those colorful squares or triangles of paper decorated with cutout designs. Writer and filmmaker John Philip Santos spoke to Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan about going to fiesta parades as a child with his grandmother. She pointed out to him the contradiction that was fiesta.
So grandmother, you know, kind of introduced us to the idea of fiesta, but she always said that it was the craziest thing because it was Mexicans celebrating the defeat of the Mexicans. And we never quite understood what that meant until much later when I sort of got the history background. But my other early memory was being in elementary school at Mount Sacred Heart. So every fiesta, King Antonio would come visit Mount Sacred Heart. And you know, it just always seemed very mysterious, the trappings, the little weird French cap and the turquoise blazer. And so he seemed very alien and... yeah, I guess we were feeling a lot of kind of anti-colonial ardor about kind of confronting this you know, ersatz king.
The very concept of royalty in San Antonio is like, I mean, what?
Well, you know, I've been at the Fiesta Patria in Santa Fe, and there you see parades with folks in the trappings of the conquistadores. So Spanish, New Mexican pride in that legacy. But here in San Antonio, there was none of that. And this was long before there were Aztec dancers in the San Antonio parades. It was always a sense of a kind of performance of Anglo dominance. You know, I mean, it had that feeling from the very beginning, a kind of a way of publicly exhibiting a kind of triumph of a certain part of the community.
And then that's what it felt like, too, is what you're saying.
Yeah, particularly around the iconography of King Antonio and then the royal courts. There was this undercurrent of tension or exclusion that always marked the experience, at least for me. You know, my grandmother just liked parades, so she was willing to kind of overlook this, even as she told us that, you know, this was a celebration of the defeat of the Mexicans. What's interesting for me about the fiesta these days is the way that it's been sort of transformed from within.
Do you remember when you first started really coming around to, yeah, this is a little weird?
It wasn't anything where we saw ourselves. The Mexican-American community didn't see itself reflected in the fiesta as a ritual. The Battle of Texas Independence, you know, was something that evolved over a period of 70 to 100 years. In some respects, the last battles, the spasms of violence of that conflict were still transpiring in the early part of the 20th century. You know, so with the inception of the fiesta around that time, there was a kind of an ideological battle that was being advanced psychically, you know. So, you know, increasingly we were becoming aware of how contested this history was and increasingly aware of how much stories of migration and immigration had played out in shaping San Antonio. You know, that we were always a place of confluence, that we were always a place, a kind of a crossroads.
I don't know if it's an embrace of culture or a cultural approbation, embrace of the foods and the music and the dance and the, you know, everything of you know, Mexican American culture.
The fiesta tradition began to really reshape these narratives from within. What underlies this story is the fact that our city, 300 years old, was founded under the sun of another empire. You know, we were founded in the time of New Spain. That story, in a sense, was linked as well to the deeper indigenous origins of this place that, you know, we're told by archaeologists go back 10,000 years. It's perhaps not surprising in that respect that we see increasingly fiesta as a reflection of this deep narrative. So you know, the confluence of future and past and the sense of crossroads of cultures here, I think is, you know, kind of revealing through the lens of Fiesta our place as this kind of capital of mestizaje. You know, I really think of San Antonio as a city of metamorphosis.
Yeah, there probably are those with regard to Fiesta that are saying, Pandora, shut that box.
Right? Yeah, everything is coming forth now. I mean, just the melange, a city of mestizo processes unleashed on the world. The fact that Fiesta has been kind of commandeered as a vehicle to have some fun with that, I think can only be a good thing. You know, so I don't feel hostile about Fiesta. I think, you know, the challenge is, how do we make it our own? How do we redeploy it and reimagine it in ways that are meaningful, both as ways of having fun and ways of thinking about our incredible story, our incredible 300-year story?
That was Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan speaking with John Philip Santos, a San Antonio writer, journalist, and filmmaker. In 1979, Santos became the first Mexican-American Rhodes Scholar. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.